My sister lived in the days when there was really no social care support for children like that. They lived at home and that was it. There was a lot of prejudice when we took her out. I remember taking her out to walks in the park or the zoo or whatever, and people came up in the, came up and said, you shouldn't take her out.
You're listening to the Cannabis Health Magazine podcast, What's Your Why? My name is Hannah Deacon, and I'm joined today by Professor Mike Barnes. We will be discovering the reason why people we're speaking to have such an interest in cannabis. What motivates them? Who were they before they came into this industry? How do they think things could work better for patients? We're taking an in-depth look into what makes people tick with an informal conversation which won't focus on graphs and commercial outlooks, but what drives them and why cannabis and the part they play in bringing it to the UK matters to them. Hello, Mike Barnes.
Hello, Hannah Deacon.
Really weird to be interviewing you, but we're going to give it a go.
Yeah, we'll see what comes out.
So, you're well famed for being a leader in the UK medical cannabis sector, but I want to know about you before you got into cannabis.
Well, I was born in North London and moved all over the country since, as I've got no accent at all because it's all been levelled off, if you like. And in East London, I was an only child for about 5 years. Then my sister was about 5 or 6 years younger than me. Went to school in Walthamstow, which is North East London, which was good. I enjoyed school. I enjoyed the fun. We've recently met about 8 or 9 people in the same class. We met 45 years later, which was an interesting evening, as far as I remember. Went to grammar school. Then I applied and went to Bristol University to do medicine. I didn't really want to do medicine. I wanted to do biochemistry, but I was told by the careers people and my mother that biochemistry wouldn't make any money and you needed to be a doctor. So, stupidly, I agreed with that. Although, in fairness, I've had an interesting medical career. I don't think I could have stood being a specialist doing nothing but specialties. For years, I was trained as a neurologist, and what I couldn't stand was sitting in clinics day after day, seeing people with endless headaches and funny turns, which is what the bread and butter neurology is. Mm. But I like neurology. Oddly, I went into it because it was the most difficult specialty at the time, which says something probably not too flattering about my own personality, I think. Because, I wanted to succeed in the most difficult thing.
Yeah,
which is
but that's good because you're driven, and that's good. That's not a bad thing. So tell me a bit more about family life. You talk a bit about your mother sort of telling you to be a doctor, and how was the dynamic in your family?
Well, I think best thing to say is that I had a sister who was about 5 years younger than me, I think, who died when she was about mid-30s. She had cerebral palsy, very severely. She couldn't walk, talk, needed feeding, and had, more particularly relevant to years, she had severe, profound epilepsy with multiple seizures every day. And I do, as an aside, I do wonder whether she would have lived, because she died from what's called sudden unexpected death and epilepsy syndrome, in the context of multiple seizures. I wonder if she would have lived if cannabis had been around in those days, because she died in the 70s, I would guess. So I suppose I was partly influenced, I suppose, in retrospect, I didn't think so at the time, by my mother, who, my sister lived in the days when there was really no social care support for children like that. They lived at home and that was it. There's a lot of prejudice when we took her out. I remember taking her out to walks in the park or the zoo or whatever, and people came up in the came up and said, you shouldn't take her out.
What?
I mean, it's extraordinary. This is the 60s, and that was, so I saw prejudice in the roar, as it were.
Yeah.
And then my mother, credit to her, although she was incredibly irritating to a 14-year-old, but she managed to get herself in the local press.
Good for
her. She did a sit-in on the mayor's office. So I'm not leaving his office until you get a respite for my child. And she did. I mean, it was very early days when that really wasn't the done thing at all, although even though it was the 60s and there were students. But, a middle-aged, middle-class woman didn't do that sort of thing.
Campaigning,
So I think that, in retrospect, probably influenced me, although it wasn't conscious.
No.
And I ended up in the field of looking after, in a sense, people with chronic long-term disabilities, and you know, it doesn't take much of a Freudian analysis, if that's the right phrase to think, how did I end up in that? But I didn't end up in that consciously, actually.
No.
Interesting. It's interesting I have ended up in a similar related field.
Yeah. And do you think, I'm interested in this, obviously, because I have a daughter who is now six and who's grown up with a brother with epilepsy. How do you think that having a sister with such profound disabilities affected you? Or do you think it didn't affect you in a good way or a bad way?
I think credit to my parents. They brought me up in a very normal household.
Mm.
Other than the fact that Janet was there, very severely disabled, they didn't ignore me, which I think some families can do. They can focus all on the child with a disability. They didn't do that.
Mm.
They made it a normal childhood. I wasn't really aware in any serious sense that I was growing up in a slightly different household. So credit to them. I think probably...
So do you feel like your mother, because I can only imagine the grief that she must have felt because of, and especially, and your father, but I think mothers especially feel that grief having a disabled child, and you didn't feel that you witnessed that grief from her?
No. Anger, if anything, that she wasn't getting help that she felt she was entitled to.
Well, yeah.
But did I... Has it skewed me as an adult? Probably not. I think you say you I've got a daughter. Will she be? I think she'll be stronger for growing up in that sort of household. Mm. She'll understand more about disability, the problems that comes with a child with a disability. I think she'll be a stronger, more able, more rounded adult. To be honest, hopefully, I am.
You had a holiday with her in Malta, didn't you, when we went to Malta?
Yeah, and she's a lovely, totally normal.
Having a mother
and
like
having
me,
a mother
I don't
like
know
that,
how.
God knows how. But, I think she'll be great. And if fate puts you in a household like that, I think you can actually become a stronger person as a result of it.
I think you're right. And I think it's really interesting, and I'm really grateful for you talking about Janet, because I don't think people know, well, they don't know that about you. And the one thing I have seen in this being a campaigner and being in this industry is judgment. Many people judge you and all of us for the reasons we do things. And actually, I think them knowing that you've grown up with a sister with epilepsy is actually really important, because you are coming from this of a place of understanding, of a place of empathy. And as you say, could that plant have helped your sister? Probably. And that's why I think this podcast is so important, because it's really important to know who people are rather than making judgments. And, I think it's really nice to learn that about you and know that that's something
Thank
that you,
you
live through. And, you're an amazing campaigning mother as well.
Yes.
But good for her, for doing that and for asking for help and getting it. I mean, that's amazing.
So, and the time neurology was very difficult to get on in.
Mm.
And you had to really go where the jobs were. Hence, I ended up in Newcastle, which for a Londoner was miles away out of my comfort zone.
Well, I have actually visited your house, and it is miles away from civilization for me. Being a Brighton girl, it's a long way from home.
So this podcast's viewing figures have now dropped for the northeast England.
Sorry, everyone.
Plummeted
in the northeast.
Yes.
I'm not being rude. No, but
but now I'm there. It's a lovely part of the world, and it is. And it's and the tourists don't go there for some reason. A lot of people have said they've been to Newcastle. What they mean is they sat on the train as it goes through Newcastle on the way to Edinburgh.
It is a beautiful place. Where you live is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice. So we ended up there not by choice but by job, and I've stayed there. Well, I had a quick diversion from Manchester and Southampton before coming back to Newcastle. Then I was a neurologist.
Mm.
But interestingly, when I started being a neurologist, the first thing when I joined was a little hospital down the road from the main hospital. It's a big main hospital in Newcastle called the Royal Victoria Infirmary.
Mm.
And about half a mile from there, there was a little hospital called Hunter's Moor, which was effectively an overflow for older people who couldn't get out of hospital quick enough.
Right.
As a sort of a convalescent home come nursing home.
Right.
And the doctor running that was retiring, and so he asked me, would I take it over? So within a couple of weeks of starting a consultant job, I'd inherited a hospital.
Wow.
A little
hospital.
Sounds
like a good idea. It's something that we probably should have all over the country.
What, me running small hospitals?
No. a place for the elderly to go rather than being in hospital, because we have a big problem with that at the moment.
Yeah, there used to be. In the early days of the NHS, even early when I was around, there was convalescent hospitals were standard. After you'd finished your acute operation or your acute illness, you went to a little cottage hospital, if you like, often run by GPs, and it was a great system. It was more friendly. It wasn't so frenetic as the acute ward, and it worked really well. But in the early days, we're talking about the 80s, they were shutting all those hospitals at a great rate of knots.
Sad.
It was sad. So I inherited this hospital, and I thought, well, I wanted to make it into a neuro-rehabilitation facility, because neurology is great for intellectuals, but generally speaking, am I now going to be rude to all my ex-colleagues? Neurologists are pretty useless at interpersonal skills. That's a horrible generalisation, but I think it's generally true, because neurology attracts academics who love the diagnosis, if you like. They like chasing the diagnosis. Once you've made a diagnosis in neurology, at least 20, 30 years ago, you couldn't do anything about it. You told someone they had multiple sclerosis, and you told someone they had motor neuron disease, and that's what you've got. Thank you very much. Good morning. And off they went. And you never did anything about their follow-up or their support. Because you couldn't cure it.
No, and I that has been my experience. I'm very lucky now that Alfie's neurologist is exceptional and very available to talk to us, but I'm afraid my experience with doctors, with my son, has been very similar. Life-changing news, and there's no support afterwards, and there's no there's no empathy, there's no connection with anyone, and I know that many, many families feel the same. So you're absolutely right. I think, unfortunately, it's not changed.
No, I think some of the younger neurologists are more person-orientated than they used to be. But I never did like that, and I've always felt that it wasn't right to tell someone they got a major life-changing diagnosis like multiple sclerosis in their, you know, in their midlife. They got family, they got jobs, all that's going to fall by the wayside. And we did nothing about it.
No.
And I never liked that. So I took the advantage of this little hospital I'd inherited to change it into a rehabilitation centre for people with neurological problems. That's largely brain injury from the neurosurgeons and multiple sclerosis, motor neuron disease, muscular dystrophy, those longer-term neurological problems. That was 70-odd beds. It was a big unit. And we were very lucky at the time. We had a very supportive regional medical office, they used to call them. In those days, there was the Regional Health Authority. And the chairman of that, a lovely guy called Sir Bernard Tomlinson, and the medical director, who was equally a lovely guy, called now Sir Liam Donaldson, who became England's chief medical officer. They were very supportive of the idea, and they gave us money to make it happen.
Great.
In the days when you could just make a good case to the hierarchy, and it happened.
Yeah.
These days you have to go through 17 different committees and then get it not funded.
Yeah.
So we made what turned out to be really a national, if not international, neurorehabilitation centre at Hunter's Moor Hospital in Newcastle.
That's amazing achievement. And I think a lot of people don't know that about you, that you have you know, worked all over the world in that capacity as a rehabilitation specialist, and, you know, extremely experienced, a very, very successful career. And I think it, you know, it's really interesting to know that about you, rather than, you know, you're not just the medical cannabis doctor.
No, it's very odd to work for all my working life in neurology and neurological rehabilitation and be reasonably well known in that field globally, if I say so myself. But then end up, the thing I'm probably going to be known for, if I'm known for anything, when I retire is cannabis. I don't know where that came from.
Well,
all of a sudden.
How did you decide that this was going to be your next route in your career then? How did that happen?
Well, I was interested in it, and to get it out of the way, I didn't smoke much pot at school, any pot at school, having started that.
We're not supposed to use the word pot. We're working really hard to move away from that.
We can't do that anymore. I spoke no medicinal cannabis at school at all. So my sum total, my cannabis experience was about half a joint at university, mixed with several pints of alcohol. Beer and
Did you have a white tea?
I didn't like it then, and I never had it. So it wasn't born from personal experience.
No.
I'm sorry to disappoint the Daily Mail, but it wasn't. So I've lost the track, and I was going to tell you how I got into cannabis. That's it. It was really, it's a tale you've heard, but I was doing multiple sclerosis clinics in Newcastle, and people were coming in. This was at least 20, 25 years ago. And the people coming in and saying, I've using cannabis. And it helps my pain, and it helps my spasticity, which is muscle spasm, a very common disabling problem in MS. And so I just informally asked people turning up to the clinic. It wasn't a research study in any way. I just asked, chatted to people, and about 50% of them were using cannabis or had tried cannabis, which was a brave move, because you've got to remember, A, it was illegal, and still is, in that sense. And these are people with very severe disabilities who had to go and get it, or get their brother or their mother or their sister or their to get it, and risk criminalisation. And so I thought, well, if they're going to risk that, there must be something to it.
Yeah, it didn't make you feel... I think that, you know, having spoken to a lot of people, many doctors get very defensive when they're spoken to about cannabis. So it didn't make you feel like that. It didn't make you think, oh, you know, it didn't make you angry. It actually made you intrigued, made you interested.
That's interesting. Well, this was a plant that must have been doing some good. Otherwise, people wouldn't be risking it. And I thought, well, there must be something to this. So I looked into it. In those days, there wasn't much to look into, remember, because it was illegal. There was very little research done. Yeah. In those days, even the endocannabinoid system hadn't been discovered.
No.
So it was really, really early days. So there wasn't much to learn about it. But I did learn what there was. And then by chance, I generally can't remember how they alighted upon me, but GW Pharma approached me to help them with the development of what is now called Sativex, which was the first licensed medication, a mixture of THC and CBD, licensed for just that, multiple sclerosis, resistant spasticity. And I was what was called the independent expert, so they presented me with a massive, great bundle of papers and research stuff, clinical, preclinical studies, and I had to say, yes, I think on balance this is a good thing to license. So that's how the interest started. So I helped GW launch. It finally got through the...
And on balance,
committee,
looking at the evidence, did you feel that it was an effective medication?
The honest answer, yeah, it was effective. Just. And I think even GW's scientists will agree that some of those studies were not wildly positive. They were positive, we wouldn't have got through otherwise. But they had to sort of slightly skew the evidence in an open sense. Because what they did was to start people on Sativex, and if you responded in the first 4 weeks, they carried on in the study. If you didn't respond, they stopped. It wasn't working, so they stopped you. So it was a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that you then analyse those.
It's going to be successful because the people that using it responded.
Exactly.
Was it against placebo? So it was a randomised controlled trial?
Yes, it was.
And was the placebo saline?
It was, yes. It was got the same...
So it's a true randomised controlled trial?
It was a proper, well-conducted study. It was, it was fine. Does side effects work? Yes. Is it brilliant for spasticity? No. And I think, in comparison to some of the other pharmaceuticals we have at the moment, Sativex is and was a nice fine tuner of spasticity, but it wasn't a definitive treatment. So, but I think they were hampered because they pushed it down the pharmaceutical route, and therefore they had to make just one ratio of THC-CBD. They had to guess that, and they probably, in retrospect, guessed it slightly wrong, and they, of course, we couldn't personalise the medicine as we now. So you were lumpered. That was it. Sativex was that. You couldn't then fill in with the
ratios. And what we do know about the endocannabinoid system now is that it is an individualised to each person's body, and actually one fixed ratio of one product is not going to help everyone because of the nature of the endocannabinoid system. So, but, I mean, very, let's say, I suppose, a historical move from them and the first creation of that medicine. And I think, you know, the research that they have done and the products that they produce were, you know,
I think they should have great credit, actually. I mean, GW is a bit criticised these days for pushing the pharmaceutical agenda, but actually they wouldn't have got it through unless they'd done that.
No.
And their scientists and their team were revolutionary in terms of analysis of the cannabinoids. And still are. So I think, you know, we shouldn't forget their historical contribution. People like Jeffrey Guy, who runs the company, I think are great pioneers, and I will always give them great credit for that.
So what happened from there? Where did you...
Well, after that, actually, nothing, really. Because Sativex was looked at by NICE, which even in those days was remarkably conservative, dull, and tedious. And they decided... Actually, in fairness, probably correctly, that it wasn't cost-effective. It didn't have enough benefit for its cost because it was quite expensive because GW invested...
Put a lot of money into it.
Millions to get it to that point. So they said it couldn't be used on the NHS. You could use it privately, but very few people did. So basically, I didn't really have much to do with cannabis then for probably the best part of a decade, if not 15 years. I carried on doing neurological rehabilitation, set up a thing called the World Federation of Neurorehabilitation, which is sort of push the agenda globally for neurorehabilitation, which was fun doing.
Mm.
But in terms of cannabis, nothing happened until I was approached again out the blue, and I still don't know quite why they found me, but they did, and that was the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Drug Policy Reform, chaired by Baroness Molly Meacher.
Mm.
And she asked me to do a sort of review of the whole efficacy of cannabis, which was a big deal. They wanted it done in a month. Which we actually did in the end. We being my daughter and I, Jenny.
Mm.
Jenny's a doctorate in clinical psychology. Mm. And she wrote the mental health sections of that report. So we produced that. And I think it's one of those things where you find yourself thrust into the limelight because there's no one else in the limelight, if you see what I mean. There's no one else had written anything like that.
No.
With any, you know, any degree of thoroughness.
No.
And in the UK, at least, I was the only person who'd done it.
Yeah.
Therefore, suddenly you're the expert, even if you're not, because there's nobody else to ask. There's no one else there. Well, we better have him then.
yes.
And that was then, I think, the next significant thing was you.
Mm.
With Alfie and his story.
Mm.
And being approached by Peter Carroll from NDAR Payne to say, could I help with developing the license for Alfie?
Mm.
And the rest, as they say, is... his history.
Yeah, that was an amazing time, and we're forever grateful to you for putting in months of work and enduring the Home Office, and they didn't know what they were
doing.
It was fun. Yeah, it was
fun. I think, you know, it's fashionable to criticise the Home Office, but actually...
I think they were very good, within
the boundaries of their law and the bureaucracy surrounding it. I think they were actually very supportive, very helpful.
Yeah, I do. And I think we have to remember that the people, the civil servants within that within the Home Office have all grown up, I'm sure, with the notion that cannabis is dangerous. And I remember when we got our licence, Nick Hurd phoned me and he just said, you know, we were just really worried about it. And he was really honest about that. And I think that's where a lot of it came from, is they hadn't done it before. They didn't really know what they wanted, and actually they were working through from fear. And when you're working from fear with something, it is very difficult because it goes against what you've been told for many years that you shouldn't be doing. So I think on the whole, it was, could have been easier, but considering it was the first time it had been done, it wasn't too bad. And that was because of you. So
no, it wasn't.
You know,
it was...
And Peter, obviously, at NDAR Payne.
I nearly enjoyed doing it. And I'm not a great one for bureaucracy and writing and the detail they required. But actually, you knew it was worth doing. You knew you were getting somewhere.
I remember Jamie, the head of drugs policy, saying to me, you know, the reason that they could change the law is because they spent time looking at the regulations when they were working with you. You know, they could do it so quickly because they'd spent 3 months already looking at the regulations, understanding what they could do. So I think that work was really, really important on changing the law, because it wouldn't have been done so quickly if they hadn't have already done that work with us. So,
I hope Jamie goes a long way, because he was largely responsible in the Home Office for getting it through,
He was. I remember meeting him when we had the... the event on the when the law changed, when we invited everyone to the House of Lords, and he said that, you know, he was very on board, and he said, I have my own family, and obviously in his own remit as the head of drugs policy, he has to be professional, but on a personal level, I think he was always on board. So, and I think that's the thing, many people are. I think it's just very clear that so many people just still don't understand cannabis, and that's, again, they're coming from fear, aren't they? And that's something that you're now working on to try and change through education.
Yes, that's the key at the moment, is education.
Mm.
Education, education, and education, as some Prime Minister said.
Tony Blair.
That was Tony Blair, that's right.
Yes.
And you got that right. He could have been talking about cannabis, because that's the key.
It is, absolutely.
To breaking down ridiculous ignorance, stigma.
Yeah.
getting accepted largely as education. This is not frightening.
No.
It's easy to understand.
Yeah, and I think that's why cannabis is being pushed so much by patients, because, you know, we, especially parents of epilepsy, children with epilepsy, we've seen what the drugs that are available can do. And, you know, I've been asked before, oh, does cannabis make your son stoned? Well, no, but actually pharmaceuticals do. And I think that's the thing. I'm not frightened of it because I've seen what other things can do and I've seen what cannabis does for him. But we need to ensure that people that are making decisions in government and MPs and policymakers get that too. So let's talk about today. You know, what do you think can be done to improve access now, especially thinking about NICE, for example? How do you think they might be able to change their position to sort of support the licensing of whole plant cannabis products, which are more effective, we think, and we know through anecdote than
I think there's no
the
doubt
products.
Scientifically even now that the full plant product, full spectrum cannabis works better than the isolates. There's no doubt about that. I don't think it's arguable anymore.
How do you think, because there's a lot of fear from doctors about the fact that it's not batch-to-batch consistent. Yeah. I've never seen that as a problem for Alfie, and many families don't, because actually we can look at batch analysis and just adjust dosing if we need to, but actually I don't even do that with Alfie. He just has it, and actually the nuances of tiny dose changes actually for him doesn't affect him.
As most people.
I think there's a real fear from doctors saying, oh, but we can't prescribe that because it's not the same every batch, but actually, they've got in this pharmaceutical mind, haven't they?
Yeah, for the last, probably 70, 80 years, pharmaceutical industry has dominated the medical space. But we shouldn't forget that historically it was plants. Medicine was botanics, it was plants.
Yes.
It's only in the last 70, 80 years when the scheme of medicine goes on 5,000 plus years, we use plants. And there's a lot of interesting compounds in plants. A lot of pharmaceutical medicines come from plants originally,
exactly,
of course.
Yeah.
So doctors' mindsets have got to, you have to have a single molecule product that does this, and it's a very precise dosing, and it only does that. And that's plant medicine doesn't work that way.
No.
It will never be as a set thing as a pharmaceutical medicine. But you can make it, and it's not just a weed that grows in the field. You can make it to high quality standard with no contaminants, no heavy metals, no pesticides, and a pretty good batch to batch consistency, plus or minus 5 to 10%. And for plant medicine, that's okay. We needn't worry about that. And you say you get a certificate analysis with every batch, and if it's a lot different from the last batch, which it very rarely is, you just adjust the dose slightly. And so it's not something to be scared of. In fact, it's something to embrace, because the dosing isn't as critical as it is with a pharmaceutical product.
No.
And of course, the other thing is the side effects are generally much less, and you don't die of overdose of it.
No.
So doctors shouldn't be scared of it. In fact, they should embrace it, because it's a nice, easy, safe way to give people a medicine.
To deal with chronic illness as well. We're talking about people with severe, debilitating, lifelong chronic illness. You know, this is a medicine that can really change people's lives. It has for me, hence why I'm so passionate about it as well. And I think, absolutely. And again, that comes through education, doesn't it? About training doctors and helping them to understand that this isn't something to be feared.
I think that's it.
And how, back to the question, how do you think NICE can adjust their...
Well, I think what NICE should do is hang their heads in shame, go away and start again, preferably without anyone who wrote the first report on the second report. And, I mean, that's not really flippant, actually, because it was written... And I understand why it was written. It was written as if cannabis is a pharmaceutical product.
Exactly.
Let's look at this. Has it got enough double-blind placebo-controlled studies? And the answer is no, it hasn't.
So on that...
On that basis, they're right. And they didn't totally dismiss it. They said there's probably some interesting things here. But basically, to summarise a long report, they said it's too early for doctors to prescribe this, except in certain very confined circumstances. We need more evidence. Go away and get it. Now, I think that's totally wrong, because it's written by people who didn't understand the plant. And, if people interpret that as being rude to them, then so be it. But they didn't understand the plant.
No,
it's very clear from the report.
So
they need to... They need a new panel with academics, doctors and patients, people who are using it, but more particularly people who understand the plant, cannabis experts, and not just in the UK. The other thing about NICE is they're ridiculously UK-centric. They even openly rejected academic studies not in English. I mean, how ridiculous is that?
Yeah.
And there's people now in Canada, even they speak English in Canada. Australia, they sort of speak English in Australia. But there's Germany,
Israel.
Israel, Spain, Italy. You've got a lot of experience of this now. Even places where the natural British tendency is to say that's rubbish, like Uruguay, you've been doing this for a long, long time. Let's look at the experience worldwide. Let's learn from the thousands and thousands of observational studies and other good quality studies that aren't double-blind placebo control. Let's look at that evidence, and then they will come to a different conclusion, because they hide behind the fact that their guidelines are just guidelines. That's true. But they're actually mandatory, because no hospital will go against the doctors will be very brave if they're going against the NICE guidelines, and when they have to get permission from their trust to prescribe it, they're not going to go against NICE. So effectively, what NICE says has stopped the industry in its tracks.
Yeah, and I think it's very, very sad.
It's very sad.
I think you're absolutely right. The NICE regulates or assesses single compound pharmaceuticals. This is not a single compound pharmaceutical. No. It's a polypharma in itself because of the way it works.
Exactly.
And they need to accept the exceptionality and build a framework around that. And if that means setting up an office of medical cannabis like they have in Holland,
that's exactly what they need.
That's what they need to do. And you're absolutely right. When I went to meet the Home Office for the first time and took Alfie's report from our neurologist in Holland, they literally dismissed it and said, "Oh, but she's Dutch." I was just like, "Okay, really? You know, their health service is far more advanced than ours, it seems, when we were there." You know, so it is sad, and you're absolutely right. There's so many people across the world with great expertise that we could be drawing upon, and it would be very revolutionary for them to do that. But yes, they should do it.
They must do it,
because it's a botanical medicine. It's not a single compound pharmaceutical. And actually, what we have to remember as well is that pharmaceutical companies are not going to invest millions into doing randomised controlled trials in a plant, because it can't be patented.
They can't make money from it.
They can't make money from it. And
I understand
we have to remember they're making, you know,
they're
pharmaceutical companies are there
money.
To make money. They're not there for the good of our health. Basically.
So you can't blame them for not doing that, because they're not going to get the return from it.
Exactly. And I think that's, we have to have a workaround, because actually what is going to happen, and in the case of the campaign work I do supporting the NDAR pain families, is that many families are suffering severely. They're having to pay for private prescriptions. They have lost all their services and their support because of COVID. And it's absolutely barbaric the way these people have been treated, as far as I'm concerned. And I think, as you say, they should hang their heads in shame. It's disgusting. There should be a workaround for people who've proven that it helps their children or helps themselves. And until that access route can be dealt with, it should be funded. You know, there is going to be problems with access. We do need to go back to the drawing board and work out the advice that doctors should have and things like that. But that's going to take a long time. And in that sense, we should be funding prescriptions now. How do you think this journey with cannabis has changed you as a person, or do you think it has? What do you think you've learnt from it?
A lot of things. Well, first of all, I learned a lot about cannabis, and the more the interesting thing, I think, as you grow up, as it were, is when you realise that you know so little about something. And I suppose if you'd asked me 20 years ago when I founded MS, I thought, I know all about cannabis now. I knew virtually nothing about cannabis, and I still know very little, because there's so many things in the plant that we just don't understand. So I've learnt a great deal about cannabis as a medicine. I think I've learnt to understand and embrace a botanical view of medicine, things I don't know much about, but other products like turmeric or ginger or whatever, other plants as well. I think there's so much that we don't know, and so much we've dismissed in a sort of arrogant sort of way. So I've learned to embrace that different sort of medical approach. I've seen actually the really good side of many, many people. There are many people in this space who've done so much good, often for very little personal income, if you like. They've done it because they really feel passionate about it. I've also been exposed to, I think, patient power. I think this has been a patient, I'm not sure I like the word patient, but let's use it for the moment, a patient-led revolution. And that's what I would embrace now. I'd encourage people to go and not beat their doctors up, I nearly said, but beat the door down. This is what I want. It's safe. Here's the evidence. I want to see this patient revolution pushing it forward. Because if you wait for doctors to do it, it'll never happen.
No, because they're frightened. And you know, I suppose rightly so. Many of them are protecting their livelihoods and their careers, and they don't want to be ostracised for being the cannabis doctor.
And I think a lot of doctors forget actually they're there for the patient and they're not there for themselves or their careers or to keep their masters in the hospital happy.
We must remember Hippocrates, first do no harm. And I think, I'm afraid, there's a lot of doctors inflicting harm, probably very, very much unintentionally, but they're inflicting harm by not giving access to especially these children with epilepsy because they're frightened. And actually, it'd be nice to just, you know, stand up and go, do you know what, this is the right thing to do. I don't care.
Yes, and there's still only something like 27 doctors prescribed in this country, which is a tiny, tiny number. And great credit to those 27.
Absolutely. Pioneers.
They are pioneers. And the more we slowly but surely train to embrace it. And I'm not a great believer in private. I'm not a believer at all in private medicine, actually.
No.
I was a lot criticised in social media for helping to establish the first or one of the first private medical cannabis clinics, the medicalcannabisclinics.com. And in one sense, I'm not proud of that.
No.
Because it's private medicine, it shouldn't be, it shouldn't happen. The other way, I am proud of it, because it allowed what is now 2,000 people to get a prescription they would otherwise have got, even though it's got a lot of money for them and it's got a lot of sacrifice for them. But those 2,000 people go back, they'll talk to their GP, they'll talk to their hospital consultant, hopefully, they'll talk to their neighbours and their friends, and the message that cannabis is helpful will get out there. So there's 2,000
people walking
if you
around
take the,
talking about
if
it.
If you take the newspaper circulation thing, I think newspaper people say, you know, for every printed copy, six people read it or something. Probably that number's not quite right. But let's say 5 people, 2,000 times 5, that's 10,000 people now who've directly heard about cannabis.
Being beneficial.
More than that.
Yeah.
And the more we can get out there. So that's why I'm in favour of private medicine at the moment.
Because it does give access. And then
it does
there
give
wouldn't
access
be any
to those who wouldn't get it otherwise and spreads the gospel, I suppose you could say.
And I suppose what we would hope is that the private sector will realise, because they're working in a health-orientated market, that they will try and reduce prices as quickly as
the prices are coming down, as you know. I mean, the families with epilepsy were looking at £2,000 plus a month earlier this year. It is this year. Now it's, well, if you're on the Project 21 project, £150 a month. But for those with epilepsy who aren't yet on that, you're looking at what, average of £500-600 a month, something of that order. So it's a roughly a quarter of what it was. And it's got to go on with even £500 a month is a lot for a lot
it's
of people.
Too much money. Too
far too much. But it's a quarter of what it was. And if we keep going down and more people get prescribed and the cost comes down, the more that message will spread. And hopefully what we really need is
I think it'll happen. It's just not happening quick enough. You know, when you're looking after a child who's having seizures every day, tomorrow isn't quick enough. They haven't got years to wait.
No, they certainly haven't got years to wait for NICE's suggestion
of double-blind
controlled studies. Often would be dead.
Well, exactly, and that's the reality. They have said, oh, well, you know, we can put these children from endopain on a trial. Well, the reality is that they'd have to be washed out of their product to go on a trial.
Yeah, that's
barbaric and disgusting and actually puts these children at risk of death. They haven't thought it through. That's not acceptable. They need to go back to the drawing board and work out how they fund these prescriptions for these children, or put them on a trial of Bedrolite and collect their data. I mean, no one other than drug science has looked at Alfie's data since he's been on medical cannabis since 2017, which I think is also disgraceful. He should have been followed the whole time, but there we go. So finally, negatives. It's been very positive, but let's talk about, has there been
negatives
for you?
I mean, there have been negatives for the campaign because, you know, 2 years on, we've still only got 3 NHS prescriptions. So, but personal negatives, interesting that, well, I've seen the good side of many people, I've also seen the bad side of many people, and I think my view of many of my medical colleagues has gone down because they seem to be arrogant, stuck in a different era, scared of doing the right thing. And I didn't realise to the extent that was the case amongst my medical colleagues till I started this campaign.
I think we probably have to blame these societies for that, though. I'm afraid, like, you know, the BPNA, British Paediatric Neurology Association, putting out guidance saying that THC will damage the growing brain without actually giving evidence of what...
And the Royal College of Physicians' guidance
And I think that's very difficult when you're in... You know, it's a human nature, isn't it? When you're in a gang and the gang say you can't do that, then it's very difficult to go outside of the gang, isn't it?
It is, but it's a pity that not more doctors take notice of that, but then decide what's the best for the patient sat in front of them.
Holistically decide patient by patient.
And also there's people in this industry who con people who just in it for a quick buck. So I've seen the worst side of, if you like, of capitalism as well. Get rich quick merchants are prevalent in this space, I'm afraid, along with some really good people who want to do it for good, solid, ethical reasons. So I think that's the only downside. I've seen perhaps the unsavoury side of human nature as well as the very good side of human nature.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Professor Mike Barnes. I've really enjoyed learning a bit more about you as a person. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.